Major funding for the series is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting with support from PRI, Public Radio International.
This is Crossing East. Our stories, our history, our America.
The United States continues to have this image throughout the world of a land of opportunity. The 65 reform laws were very family-oriented.
After we immigrated to the United States, we always think about it to open a business, a family business.
We were the pioneers, and we were the nurses who set up the policies, the procedures that this new hospital was going to use.
The new immigrant really bring life to America like in Chinatown.
I'm Margaret Cho. Up next, the stories of the post-65 generation on Crossing East.
I'm Dee Mae Roberts with the Crossing East music feature. Pianist John Jang's first instrument was actually the snare drum, which he played to Sousa marches in the school band in fourth grade. In his teen years, he heard John Coltrane and he was inspired to play jazz.
Yes, when I heard the music of John Coltrane, specifically the live version of My Favorite Things, it became like my Bible. I mean, I wore out the record. And then in high school, I had a history teacher who was a Stanford grad. And so he knew that I was interested in music and that I loved music, even though I didn't perform it. And he gave me the book Blues People by Leroy Jones, who is now Amiri Baraka. And this is my first introduction to how I learned how the music was related to life. And the basic premise of that book was that as the lives of African Americans change, the music change. So this music was about the changing tradition.
Changing traditions is what Jang ended up doing through his music. Growing up in the 70s in the middle-class suburban Palo Alto, California, he could count the number of Asian kids in his school on one hand, but the times demanded he reach outside of his surroundings.
People were looking outside of, you know, that Leave It to Beaver mentality, and they were seeing, you know, the changes that were going on in this country as well as all over the world. And so there were different kinds of movements such as, you know, the student movement, oppressed nationalities, or what we call people of color movement today, women's movement, gay and lesbian movement. People were sharply redefining society. And part of it, as an American-born Chinese, was connecting to the history of finding out, well, who am I? And in order for me to know who am I needed to know where I came from.
Jang studied at Oberlin Conservatory of Music and started playing piano at 19.
I just loved music. I wasn't really conscious about whether I was going to make a career out of it. I was just under a lot of pressure just trying to keep up because most of the piano performance students, you know, they started when they were either 3, 6, 7, 10, and they had, you know, the best pianos, the best piano teachers, had gone to music school camps. So I had to try to keep up.
To keep up, he began performing with other musicians. Jang created a path for himself he calls Two Flowers on a Stem, the symbiotic relationship of his cultural identity with honoring tradition while pushing the boundaries. Later, he used that metaphor for the title of a song he dedicated to his mother, who raised him alone. His father tragically died in a plane crash when Jang was 2 years old.
I dedicated Two Flowers on a Stem to my mother because the brother of my father's best friend told me the story about that my father's funeral service in 1956 was denied at the Glendale Cemetery because my family was Chinese. I mean, there was no body. No body of my father. It was burnt to ashes. And so my family had to hold the funeral services at Hollywood Hills.
Jang has been a music activist as well. With friend and fellow musician Francis Wong, they formed Asian Improv Records to give young Asian artists in jazz more opportunities.
The model for me was Paul Robeson, because he was an artist citizen. He was a great artist. And, you know, he wasn't trying to be political. But if you, part of your purpose is to try to find out who you are and where you come from, and you're trying to do that on a level that you need to be satisfied within yourself, then for me, it's always going back to history and seeing how that relates to the present.
John Jang's new CD is called Paper Sons, where he continues to investigate Asian American history and the lessons to be remembered.
My greatest failure is my greatest success, because failure is an aspect of discovery. If you don't try to live your dreams, then you're not living.
To find out more about John Jang, go to crossingeast.org. This Crossing East music feature was produced with funding by the National Endowment for the Arts. I'm Dimae Roberts.
I'm Margaret Cho, and this is Crossing East. Our stories, our history, our America. We're featuring the post-65 generation. Composer John Jang got inspiration from the jazz artists of the 1960s, John Coltrane, Miles Davis. Their music reflected a time of great change in America. Thanks to the achievements of the Civil Rights Movement, President Lyndon B. Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act of 1964, outlawing discrimination based on race, color, religion, or national origin. A year later, he signed the Voting Rights Act of 1965, prohibiting any kind of requirement, including a literacy test, that discriminated against voters on the basis of race. That same year, President Johnson signed legislation abolishing national origin quotas since the Immigration Act of 1924. The Immigration Act of 1965 removed the last vestiges of racial discrimination in this nation's immigration policies and made it possible for Asians to sponsor and bring over their families. Till then, Asian countries were each restricted to only 100 immigrants each year, a trickle compared to the waves of European immigration. The 1965 Act united families and welcomed highly educated, technical, and professional workers from Asia. Many wanting better jobs came from India, China, the Philippines, and Korea.
This is a frozen meat market, and right side have a produce section. Walk it in, and front of the side is meat department. And also left-hand side get in and liquor department and wine department.
Don Myung runs the Trojan Market in Los Angeles. Don immigrated to America in 1971 when he was 22. A college student in Korea, he worked as a computer technician for a while. But his English was limited, so he left the job. His wife, Floria, came a few years later. She was a school teacher in Korea, but didn't speak English well enough to get a job here. So they bought a mom-and-pop store in 1982 in a low-income neighborhood.
2 years later, I built up the business. Then I sold it, then I buy another liquor store, and then I make a good money. And believe it or not, $500,000 I make. That time I was early 30.
Most Korean immigrants after 1965 were college educated, but because of language barriers, they had to find new ways to support themselves in the U.S. Today, more than 1 million Koreans live in the U.S. Los Angeles has the largest Korean population outside of Korea. Nearly 30% are self-employed in businesses like Don and Floria Myung's Market. 45% are small grocery and liquor stores. Chapter 1, A Grocer's Life.
Mr. Henry, yes, I know. He's my good customer.
It's very nice though. Very nice though.
People used to be in this area, a lot of USC professor and a lot of good people living. Those people move. And also the other side has a good people living, family people, they moving out. And then start coming into all the Latino community, coming 70% coming in. And then you change the business. And I have to using the grocery store and meat market and produce market, and I have to go with them. So it's and low profit and hard labor, a lot of high labor and a lot of work. It's very difficult to run business. Work like a donkey and try to survive to my life. That's it. Get up home on 6:30 and shower and 7:30. Then come in here 20 after 9. Long drive, I live in Gajung Grove until stay 10 o'clock, 7 days a week. So go home and 10 after, 20 after 11. Then shower after 12 o'clock. No personal life in run business. I want to quit sometime.
No, my husband working hard, better than me. I supposed to be, I just, you know, take care of my and the kid. It's a long time ago.
My wife come, she's work Tuesday, Wednesday, Friday. She work 3 days a week.
This business is the penny business, right? This is a penny business and everything small, organized. Is this successful in a penny business.
She's a general manager, handle everything.
Because even wife coming last night.
So I'm just worker and she the boss.
That's why he, you know, emergency, he can come in and working today.
Okay, and everything watching the employee, they, you know, supervising the employee, and just, you know, I check the everything, receiving the merchandise, and the count money, and the money just, you know, all, you know, organized. Also the paperworking and the, you know, working in the payment.
No, okay? I'm waiting for you, okay?
Well, I do my own everything, but kind of burned out on myself now. And she come in kind of fresh and try to, and such and thing, she want to more organized than I do, and more detailed organizing. Before, it's not really a problem, I'd let them go. Because I'm already kind of burning here to work 7 days, work open to close.
All right, sweetheart. Okay, Mahami, how we doing, honey?
All
right. Were we right on the money?
My name is Isaac Romero, and I'm a representative of Interstate Brand. And I come in here and I serve Twinkies and cupcakes to Donnie and his store, Trojan Market. Donnie's very good to the people in this neighborhood, and he has a very successful business here. During holidays, Thanksgiving and whatnot, he's cooking outside for the low-income people, and he's very good to them. He's a very, very good person. He's just somebody that cares about his customers, and they, in turn, come here and shop.
Ashuma, bonito, no?
I do equal treatment as business person.
Social market, have you?
My father was a businessman. I tried to run business because my father owned a bread company in Korea. And that time I tried to get married and tried to get some airplane fee and quick as possible get married. So I do building maintenance. Daytime I go to school and repair a computer. That time I didn't speak English. So I getting job and I quit myself 2 months later because so much call office to repair a shop, but the owner is out and I'm the person myself and I don't understand what they say. So I getting depressed myself and I quit.
Hey. Okay, how are you?
I wish that really my own career. When I college and after, graduation after, I just was teacher. 1972, 73, so I meet him first time. When I come in this country, I wish to, you know, this teacher aid, something like that. I want that kind of job. But I lost. When I come in this country, after 2 months, I got a baby. Still baby, no choice.
We married start family in this country, and no time to enjoy my life. And I just work. So far, what I see last 30 years. But riot hit me in 1992.
It's a really tough neighborhood, very tough. They can turn on you real quick. But after meeting Donnie, he told me all about it. It was really kind of sad, the story that he told me, because he lost his business.
April 29th, riot, Los Angeles riot. That day, Wednesday, I was day up day. I always stay home. And I see a TV and Trojan on it. And then that time they called me, a neighbor, "Hey, Don, your store burning." So my wife cried, my daughter and me crying. I didn't know, it's no experience to riot. And I didn't know that they're going to burning. Maybe looting and poor people. But I wasn't respect to get a burning.
After riot, the other day, next day, we came here. All just, you know, ash, smoke. All lost, everything lost.
That life changed. After that, we're thinking so much. And how we going to be living?
After all, what can I do? How do I living? We just go to the food stamp. Food stamp, they give me only just $180. We never experienced it. We go to the food stamp place. That means just go out, food stamp, or they pay $200.
Then I say, "What is this letter?" And I show to my daughter, "Honey, what is it?" "Daddy, you cannot open store." I have to go back to City Hall. "Hey, what is this?" City government give him to so much hard time to reopening. A lot of things to give him zoning problem and planning problem. We have to go through to open store. And city government should have helped us. They didn't protect a good citizen. We licensable and tax person, good citizen. They didn't protect us to burning to all the store. And they give me start getting problem to reopen back the store.
So then after that, he just, you know, opened the, you know, next door in the business, in the hat and the socks and the t-shirts. But business too, you know, nobody came. They lose money too. There's a riot and they all lose money. That and does lose money. Everything lose. We can't do anything.
Not even penny have income 3 years. Think about how we living. So that's why I lost my house and everything. So I use a credit card and all kind of whatever I can, I use it. And right after store opening, it's not like it used to be. They change. A lot of good people move out and after riot. I thought I open up same thing like before. It's not. It's a complete change.
But I've been serving this store for about 8-9 years, and I've gotten to know Donnie very well. So he's a great person. He really is. I love him and Floria very much. He's built it up again. He's doing very well. He's very successful out here.
After we got a more, you know, a stronger mind, my husband and me, a stronger mind, more, you know, working hard, more everything, more successful.
I'm proudly living here in this country. I'm a citizen here. So I'm going to die here. This is my country. I love the country here. But I do have a hard time to living to last 10 years after riot. But still I love country. I learned so much after riot. And I will support the country. And I'm born in Korea, but my life is here.
A Grocer's Life by D. May Roberts with contributing producer Mia Kim. In a moment, a motel family in Chicago. This is Crossing East. I'm Margaret Cho.
You're listening to PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Margaret Cho, and we're looking at the post-65 generation. The Apache Motel is located on a busy street in Chicago. It's one of thousands in the U.S. owned by South Asian immigrants. According to the Asian American Hotel Owners Association, more than a third of hotels and motels in the country are owned by Asian American entrepreneurs like Manu Patel. He came to the U.S. from the Indian state of Gujarat, following his brother-in-law. Chapter 2, The Family Business.
So here we are at my place. It's called Apache Motel, and it's on a Lincoln Avenue, north side of Chicago.
My name is Manu Patel.
My name is Kruti Patel.
And I'm 60 years old.
I'm 28 years old.
I have a wife, four daughters.
It's a small little place. We have 27 units, about 50 plus year old.
My dad runs around like crazy every day.
I am a hotelier full-time for last 25 years.
He has five properties.
I have three independent and two franchise. One is Super 8 and one is Days Inn.
I'm going to show you this room. And let's see. It's 25-inch color cable TV, king-size bed, comfortable. Here's a refrigerator, and you have a place to have a...
About myself... I am from India, small town called Syadla, S-Y-A-D-L-A. My parents were farmers. 1967, I got married. 68, and I had the first daughter. And in 1970, I had the second daughter. Back home, the way our culture is, you have to have at least one baby boy. So in the older age, usually son take care of the parents. Daughter get married, and you are left without anybody to take care in older age. So we had to try one more pregnancy, and I had a third daughter. We decided that was it, you know, and then we were happy. My wife got pregnant, which we did not plan. And I had a fourth daughter.
They had me, another girl.
We were happy with whatever the children we had, but my parents were disappointed.
So his friend was like, okay, look, now you got four girls. You're not going to all be able to survive here.
To give them a good education, we decided that we should go to U.S.
And so that's why we came here. More or less because I was born.
Front desk. Yeah, how can I help you? Yes, sir.
I started working as a night clerk.
That'd be very fine.
And then started working two shift.
And my mom cleaned rooms, and then there was me a year and a half.
So we started saving money. And the way our community worked, we help each other. So I had some money of my own. My relatives helped me some, and so many friends of mine, they helped me like $2,000, $4,000, $10,000. One of our family friends owned a 30-unit hotel in a small town called Kutztown in Pennsylvania. They found out that I'm looking for the hotel. So the family friend financed the place for me. That's how I got in.
I'm going to take you to my other property. It's called Budget Inn and Suites.
Growing up in America, being a foreigner, even though I didn't have an accent, it wasn't bad until, you know, when you're young and you don't understand why people are calling you Dothead and Gandhi Lover and all of these things. And you kind of, you know, kind of like, okay, why? Well, you never really stop to think that, oh, okay, because I'm brown. You know?
The hardest discrimination I faced personally, one time, it was a long time ago, I had a customer refuse to check out past the checkout time. I called the police. And a police officer told me, let him stay a couple more hours. I said, it's fine with me, but what about, you know, the rent? And I said, it's your problem. I ask you to let him stay a couple of more hours. And I say, what if I not? He said, I can find 10 things to arrest you. And I say, since you're telling me to let him stay, I'll let him stay. And he told me on my face, you better, for your own good.
Office, may I help you? Hello?
I grew up in the hotel business, so I decided to actually stay in it. I just started working for Select Hotels Group. And prior to that, I was working at home with my parents and their business.
Medline.
We're here. Yeah, that's where we are. And this is Clybourne.
Okay, right, we're right here.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you can take take a Western bus all the way to Clybourne.
There's money. That's pretty good money. I could say that. It's a good investment.
My youngest daughter, she's a little precious thing for us. She's still with us, unmarried. We're looking for match.
I'm single. Yes, I'm single.
About the marriage part.
You know, it's a process, I guess, in the Indian community.
We have converted ourselves between East and West.
I'm not supposed to be single at 28. It's not a good thing.
Back home, when I got married, my parents decided the bride for me. With our children, if they find somebody of their own choice, that's great.
I, unfortunately, haven't found anybody on my own.
If not, they ask us if we can provide them some information.
When I was, I think, about 22, 23, I told my parents, you know, I'm ready to get married. Yeah, I felt like I was done school. You know, I was still working. I was just working at home. So I was like, you know, I want to get married. It's the next step in life anyways, right? One of the things that really surprised me was, you know, I thought that growing up here, you would kind of lose that Indian mentality of, okay, well, we're going to live with my parents and we're going to do this and it's going to be by my rules. And it's like, okay, I'm sorry. We grew up here. I grew up here. And I can't follow that. Not all the way through. I'll meet you halfway.
So it's a total combination of East and West. She got all the things that our country, our community, our culture says. And she got all the education, all the behavior, all the power from the Western. She can clean the house, she can do the laundry, or she will, in a motel, she will take a screwdriver, open up the outlet, and replace the receptacle with a live wire.
Hey, Brian, this is Patel. I'm at the Budget Inn in Burbank. All right, how are you doing?
I have not forgotten the help that I got from my family friends for me to grow. I'm doing the same thing. Today, somebody wants to grow, want to invest in a business. I still loan them money without any interest, as other people did for me.
Checking out. Is everything okay?
Okay.
Thank you. Have a nice day. Bye-bye.
The next thing for my mom and dad to do is to retire.
About my plans for the future.
I think they're just waiting for me to get married.
I'm waiting to see that my daughter get married.
So they can pay for a wedding and then they can retire.
And she settled down on her own. And then I'm retired. I don't need to work anymore. I'm not worried about my old age at all. They are there. They will be there. It's so satisfying.
You're leaving?
Yeah.
Was everything okay for you? Okay, come back, see us again.
Okay.
The Family Business by Chicago Public Radio's Katrin Einhorn. Featured voices were Manu and Kruti Patel of the Apache Motel. You can find photos and web links to any of our stories at crossingeast.org. Walk the halls of many U.S. hospitals, and chances are you'll find internationally trained nurses on staff. American hospitals recruiting overseas healthcare professionals is not new. The practice dates as far back as the 1950s.
They tapped Filipina nurses in particular to fill staffing shortages. Esther Simpson works at Seattle's VA Medical Center. She came to Chicago in 1973 as part of one of the largest wave of Asian immigration to the United States. By 1980, the Filipino population in the U.S. jumped to 500,000. So many medical professionals came to America that politicians in the Philippines feared a brain drain. Esther Simpson, like many Filipina nurses, have made a large contribution to the American healthcare system. Chapter 3, In Her Own Words, by KUOW's Ruby DeLuna.
Okay, let's take your blood pressure one more time since it was elevated.
At the outpatient clinic, Esther Simpson checks in with patients and gets their vitals before they see the doctor.
So 140 over 80. Okay, thank you. And you can wait outside in the waiting room. Your doctor will call you.
Simpson
next.
Is a registered nurse. On her ID badge are two pins. One is dark blue and silver for her 20-year service at the hospital.
The other one actually is a medal. Our Lady of the Miraculous Medal has always been my companion. This was given by my aunt before I left the Philippines. Yeah. I went directly to Chicago because that was where my aunt and my younger sister was. And I lived with them. It was an extension of my life from the Philippines with my family. You have problems with high blood pressure?
I have it. I've had it in the past.
I received my basic nursing training in the Philippines. After graduation, I worked in the Manila Medical Center. We were the pioneers, and we were the nurses who set up the policies, the procedures that this new hospital was going to use.
Keep your arms straight. All right, that's good.
Even though I was also holding a very top position in the hospital where I worked, my salary was not really enough for me to be able to give something to my parents or what. The salary was just enough for me.
For American hospitals, hiring Filipina nurses seemed like a natural choice. The United States has a long colonial connection to the Philippines. Its presence in the archipelago between 1898 through 1946 established an education system, among other things. And America's nursing shortage would continue to encourage the migration of Filipina nurses. In 1965, Congress changed American immigration policy that paved the way for nurses to come and stay permanently. The 1965 Act also created a preference system that favored applicants with certain professions.
I want to renew my prescription.
Okay, just press this window one and take the ticket, and you wait till your number will be called.
Okay, and then where do I go then?
The Philippine government tried to slow the flow of Filipina nurses leaving the country with little success until 1972, when then-President Ferdinand Marcos declared martial law. He shifted the country's focus to exporting goods and human labor overseas. It was right about that time that Esther Simpson came to America.
The lure of the United States to Filipino nurses is really salaries and, of course, the comforts of living here.
I'm Catherine Sinisa Choi. I'm an associate professor of ethnic studies at the University of California, Berkeley. For some of the Filipino nurses that I interviewed, these expectations were met. Some U.S. hospitals under the exchange program were exploiting Filipino nurses to do the dirtiest, the heaviest kind of nursing labor, to work on the most unpopular nursing work shifts. And for those Filipino nurses who had those experiences, these were tremendous disappointments.
We have also met Filipinos who were discriminated against. They lost their jobs, they were demoted, or they were unemployed, and I guess that was like a reality to me, that Filipinos were actually having issues as minority in America.
Two Filipino nurses charged with multiple murders in a veterans hospital in Ann Arbor, Michigan, were arraigned today, one in Detroit and one in Chicago, where she now lives. Filipano Narciso and Lenora Perez. Prosecutors suggested there might be more arrests. Two reports.
Although there was no direct evidence connecting Narciso or Perez to these crimes, they were targeted by the FBI. They were repeatedly interviewed and then eventually tried and convicted on circumstantial evidence.
The case of the Narciso Perez was a definite eye-opener for everybody because Filipinos don't believe they would be accused as murderers or made suspect because it's just, I think, intrinsic in us, very innate in us, that Filipinos, we are hardworking people, we are honest people, that we can do no wrong.
During the time that the FBI had targeted Narciso and Perez, Filipino nurses in different parts of the United States were harassed, were suspected of perhaps doing something wrong on their job, not because of any direct evidence, but because they too happened to be foreign-trained nurses from the Philippines.
This case galvanized the Filipino community because it has united different walks of life, different political leanings, different economic status.
Filipino nurses across the country began to understand their rights. They organized associations and chapters to support Narciso and Perez.
We went to Detroit during the trials to witness the proceedings in court. It was so great to see Filipinos occupying the courtroom. On the outside of the courthouse were massive Filipinos. And at the same time, we publicized the different rallies that was going around the United States.
In 1978, nearly 3 years after the FBI investigation of Narciso and Perez, federal prosecutors dropped the case for lack of motive and questionable eyewitness testimonies.
Esther Simpson.
My name is Esther Simpson, and I represent the Coalition for Filipino Veterans Equity of Washington.
Simpson's activism didn't stop with the Narciso Perez case. She has directed her lobbying efforts at restoring benefits for Filipino war veterans who fought alongside American soldiers during World War II.
I'm a justice-loving person. Any kind of injustice really, really irritates me, makes me mad, and makes me madder if the victims are minorities, women, people of color. It is in my blood that anything that is not just is something that cannot be tolerated.
In her own words, by KUOW's Ruby DeLuna. Though she's close to early retirement, Esther Simpson has no plans to quit. To this day, American hospitals look overseas to fill staffing shortages. Filipino recruits make up the largest group of internationally trained nurses in America. Thousands of Filipinos still leave their homeland to work where they can earn more money. Find out more on crossingeast.org. When we come back, a Chinese family restaurant in Minnesota. This is Crossing East and the Post 65 Generation. I'm Margaret Cho.
This is PRI, Public Radio International.
Thank you.
I'm Margaret Cho with the Post 65 Generation. Have you eaten yet? It's a common Chinese greeting, like saying, how are you? For many immigrants from China, running a restaurant has often been the only way for families to earn a living. The first Chinese restaurant started in California in the mid-1800s. Go to any city or small town in the U.S., chances are you'll find a Chinese restaurant. Chinese restaurant families are an American tradition. After the 1965 Immigration Act, new arrivals from Hong Kong, Taiwan, and China followed the path of immigrants before them, starting family restaurants. In Plymouth, Minnesota, near Minneapolis, two sisters run the Tea House Restaurant. Yolanda Wong and Melissa Ho arrived in the late 80s from Anqing in East Central China. The sisters had completed college when they arrived, along with their mother, father, and four other sisters. Sadly, within a year of arriving, their father died of cancer. Yolanda and Melissa found that running a Chinese restaurant was their best hope of earning a living. Chapter 4, The Tea House.
Okay, I'm looking for number two. Number two for two. Please follow me this way.
I am Yolanda Wen. I was born in 1968. I'm one of the owner of the Tea House restaurant in Plymouth. That's my sister, Melissa.
Okay, 20 minutes, okay? Bye-bye. Hi, how are you? Maybe?
I am Melissa Ho. I was born in 1965. I grew up in a small town, Anhui province. My dad and my mom work for government. She and my dad had a very low income. My dad had a dream to send all his girls to the United States to have a better life. My uncle applied us. He helped us immigrate to the United States. We came into the United States back to 1989. After my dad brought us here, then it's about a year that he had a cancer. He died in Beijing, China. He went back. He said he doesn't want to die here. And then we all married here and have our own life here. Yeah.
Thank you. Bye now. Can you order something to go?
You want to order something? My name is Shen Ailian. Yeah.
That's my mom. Her name is Elaine Shi. She has six daughters of the family. She was born in 1944. It's a really difficult time in China at that time when he was grow up. I still remember at that time when we were young, we couldn't buy the shoes. My grandma made the shoes for us. And she always encouraged us, said, someday you get a chance, you have to do your own business.
3925?
After we immigrated to the United States, we always think about to open a business, a family business, and to
first
watch.
First year is hard to us, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The first year. Yeah, we want to sold. We want to give up. Because we never do the restaurant business before. So it's very tough.
Chicken with fresh mushroom. Chicken with fresh mushroom. Okay. And
then we spend through so many hours at the restaurant. Whenever the restaurant need me, I have to be here. I have no day off.
We just take a turn to work.
Right.
Yeah. Sometimes the daytime I work in, but most of the time I work in for daytime because nighttime I homestay with kids. One daughter, 11 years old, one son, 5 years old.
I have one son, his name is Louis Wang. He is 14 years old. He think he will help a little bit like on weekends at the restaurant, maybe start this summer.
Number three will be next, okay? Thank you for waiting.
For this point, our husbands, Daniel and Michael, helped us a lot.
You want to order some
to go?
To go, okay.
Oh, by the way, my Melissa and I are sisters, but we married to a brothers. Our husband's parents are my parents' friends. They suggest that we make friends and fall in love.
And,
yeah,
it's kind of easy. Right. All for the authentic Sichuan style. You see a lot of Asian families. They even drive 2 hours here to get a hometown taste. That's right. Yeah.
At the beginning, we only prepared this menu for Chinese community. We even didn't have in English. More and more Chinese customers bring their American friend over, and the American friend bring their friends. We realized that, yeah, we were right. American customers really like the authentic food than we, just like we do.
Yes, yes, that's right. Yeah, I'm good to see you back.
Yeah. My mom and my sister and I very enjoy to work a business like a restaurant, and because I have a lot of people come and go, come and go. Just like we grow up, all the staff from my dad's department, all the families live in the same courtyard. I still remember the nighttime after mom and dad came home and made the dinner. Everybody bring out the tables and the chairs in the courtyard. Every family do that. We all eat dinner together. People at that time are very nice to each other. If you have any problem, everybody come to help you. We miss that part a lot.
Yeah, both is good, but it's just a different recipe. Yeah.
It's wonderful.
It's an excellent.
Yeah, really good.
Very good.
A lot of regular customers here, if they do not come, my mom and my sister will all ask about it. So what happened to that family? We haven't seen them for a while. We think about them.
Okay. The bamboo tips in Sichuan spicy sauce, okay?
Yeah, we really want the authentic food.
Oh, yes, yes, that's the one it is.
Yeah, we really enjoy to stay here. People come to see us every day, and we meet different people and hear different stories from each family. We just share the stories with customers.
Customers know us, yeah, very well, right?
Yeah.
We know the Yolanda, Melissa, your mom sometimes.
The Tea House by Mary Stuckey featured the voices of Yolanda Wong and Melissa Ho in Plymouth, Minnesota.
Right now we are in the beginning of Fuzhou Street. The reason of that is majority of people who walk on this street on Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday is almost 98% is from Fuzhou.
Hey, you know what? Today is Monday. Monday is a wedding day for Fuzhou people.
We got a wedding. Whoa, Mr. Gao.
William Chu greets people in New York City's Chinatown. He heads one of Chinatown's biggest community associations. Immigrants from Fuzhou in the Fujian province now make up the majority in Chinatown.
I still remember 34 years ago, the first time when I was in America. I come to visit Chinatown. It's just like a dead place. On East Broadway, it's a disaster area. After 3, nobody wants to walk over it. But nowadays, you walk up to 13th Street, it's still like Chinatown. All right, you go on Delancey, used to be nothing in there, and now almost on every street you see the Chinese sign there. I would say over 144 square block.
Fujianese immigrants were left out of the 1965 immigration reforms because they had few relatives in the U.S. More than 200,000 paid up to $30,000 each to be smuggled into the U.S. Like the exploited coolie laborers of the 1800s, they come here seeking a better life, but face discrimination and harsh conditions. Our final chapter, The Paradox of the Fujianese by Rhys Ehrlich.
The revitalization of Chinatown and other low-income neighborhoods of New York can be directly linked to the influx of immigrants from throughout the world.
Bill Hing, Law and Asian Studies professor at the University of California, Davis.
The United States continues to have this image throughout the world of a land of opportunity. The 65 reform laws were very family-oriented. It was about promoting family reunification. And the problem with the Fujianese migration is that the Fujianese who want to come to the United States do not have the relatives that are necessary to qualify for the different preference categories.
Fujianese immigration harkens back to the days of coolie labor, when single men worked under inhumane conditions to pay off the cost of their passage. These days, Fujianese may pay $70,000 or more and face a harrowing journey on cargo ships.
A ship carrying illegal Chinese immigrants ran aground near a beach in Queens. The ship, the Golden Venture, was one of several discovered bringing illegal immigrants from China into this country.
Mr. Dong spent a year and a half traveling from Fujian to New York. He arrived aboard the Golden Venture, a ship that gained nationwide infamy.
There was a time where I didn't have any food, any drink for 3 days. All the women, all the girls that came on the same boat as me were either raped or a lot of things happened.
It was just off this beach in the Rockaway section of Queens at 2 a.m. on June 6 that the Golden Venture ran aground on a sandbar. Pandemonium erupted on board, and the crew told everyone to jump and run.
I, on the other hand, jumped on the side near to the beach. But the person in front of me and the person in back of me all died because the waves were too big, so they were all washed off toward the beach. And I almost thought that I'll die because I drank a lot of the ocean water, and I almost gave up myself. But then I kept on swimming and swimming, and eventually I hit the beach.
Professor Hing says ships started bringing workers from Fujian 10 to 15 years ago.
These individuals live in very poor conditions, by and large. They are scrimping and saving. They also feel a duty to send money back home. They are very much in a form of bondage.
Golden Venture survivor, Mr. Dong.
I earn about $2,000 or more dollars per month. I spend like about $1,000-something on expenses, and the other $1,000 I was sent back to China to my relatives. I would ask my friends and my relatives in both in China and in the U.S. for the money to pay off in full to the snakehead. Then I would pay off my friends and relatives month by month.
Mr. Dong is seeking asylum in the U.S. as a political refugee, but Professor Hing says many Chinese Americans feel resentful when Fujianese are granted legal status as refugees.
When the Fujianese began coming in the early 90s, the Chinese American community was not quick to embrace that because there was a sense that people were breaking into line. The immigration system today is based largely on family preferences. Because of big demands from residents and former residents of Hong Kong and Taiwan and mainland China, there are backlogs that exist in the various immigration categories.
Ironically, at the same time that the Fujianese are moving here, globalization means many U.S. garment and textile jobs are moving to China.
I'm Jimmy Chang. I'm an owner of New Space Fashion Inc. We have about 60 workers working here, mostly Fujianese and Cantonese. You know, we make sportswear and bottoms, skirt and pants, you know, shirt like that. Between China and India and Vietnam, their labor is cheap over there. Our labor is $6 an hour right now. But over there, like a whole month, they don't even get $100.
I'm Lena Chen. I work for Unite here, the garment worker union. We all work together and we are fighting very hard, for example, register to vote and bring out our issues to the politicians. After many years, through the hard work by the union and the community group and the Fujianese organization, 2 years ago, we finally elect the first Chinese councilman. So it gives us courage for other voters that if we unite together, and we will get our job done.
The Fujianese seem to be following a familiar pattern for undocumented immigrants. Initially intimidated from unionizing or overt political activism, they've begun to draw on their community organizations to take the first steps towards political participation and to assert their rights.
This is one of the chairmen from Houfuk Association.
Ga Yuchen.
Right now, he's just a store owner of American ginseng. You know ginseng?
Mr. Chem is a Fujianese success story. Many immigrants like him arrived without documents, and most have stayed. Their children are citizens, and their community associations help the newest arrivals.
Right now, in the Fuzhou community, we get over 120 associations, and each association really represents one of their commune, the place, the villages. And what they do is they try to help the new immigrant members or the relative or the village people, the commune's people, to facing the difficulties, solve the problem so that they could really make a good living in here.
The way I could see it, the new immigrant really bring life to America like in Chinatown.
The Paradox of the Fujianese by Reese Ehrlich. We came in many waves and we built lives. We left homelands to make a new home. We brought our skills, training, and education to strengthen new neighborhoods, new communities. This is Crossing East, our stories, our history, our America. I'm Margaret Cho.
Crossing East is produced with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and from the National Endowment for the Arts, Bill and Melinda McGinnis, and individual donors of Media Rights Productions. Our lead scholar is Judy Young, Professor Emeritus of American Studies at UC Santa Cruz. Music was provided by John Jang from his CD Two Flowers on a Stem. Our theme music is by Shasta Tycho from their CD Spirit Drum. We had additional help with The Family Business Story from contributing producer Scotty Iseri. Archival material was provided by NBC News and the NPR Archives. The managing editor is Catherine Stifter. Associate producer is Sarah Caswell Colbert. The Crossing East engineer is Clark Salisbury, with technical assistance by Michael Johnson. The marketing and outreach director is Ping Ka. The executive producer is D. May Roberts. To find out more about Crossing East, go to crossingeast.org. Support for Crossing East comes from this station and Public Radio International stations and is made possible in part by the PRI Series Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.